Anyway, well, thank you very much for the introduction. So we will finally talk about chemistry today. So as Elisa said, this actually I'm a little bit kind of nervous because it's my last talk as part of the INAF, Istituto Nazionale di Astrofisica in Firenze, Florence. So I'm a little bit sad about that, and that's why I... Just for a minute, let me be nostalgic and show you the beautiful place where Arcetri is, if you didn't go. This is the main observatory, and you know, I had the beautiful office here viewing the whole city of Florence, so I will miss a lot. Galileo's house is just here, and you can view it actually from the top of the roof. Yeah, he spent the last years of his life there. So why do we need to study chemistry? Well, first of all, let me say that without chemistry, we actually do not really know what we are looking at, you know, inside a molecular cloud or a protoplanetary disk or whatever we are looking. So we really need to understand the chemical processes to be able to, you know, study the structure and the kinematics. We want to know actually in which region of the cloud or protoplanetary disk we are looking to have an idea of the structure and the kinematics, have an idea of the kinetic energy partition, so thermal and non-thermal motion, the ionization fraction, the gas composition, and then the cooling mechanisms, the gas temperature and the volume density, then the pressure, fundamental parameter. And then, of course, in many different environments, we need chemistry, not just in the molecular clouds in general, but, for example, along outflows, so shock structure and energetics. Maybe cloud ages, we are working on it. I mean, that's kind of a difficult thing. And many other things that, of course, I'm not going to talk about, say a few things today. I don't have much time. But, of course, these dots means that we want to make connections with the formation of, say, organic molecules and that are seen, especially around young stellar objects where dust grains evaporate their mantles and show this beautiful chemistry that is actually, you know, the missing link to then go even farther and talk about astrobiology. But that's it. That's too far away from where I want to go today. Main uncertainties in chemistry, there are several, and here I list what I think are the main. So cosmic ionization rate is something that we kind of had a scary discussion yesterday, and that's yeah, after that there was kind of a moment of oblio, and everybody forgot about that. And then elemental abundance, and here in particular I refer to metals, because we kind of know cosmic abundances, but in dark clouds and more, say, denser clouds, metals tend to stick on dust grains, and then if the metal sticks on dust grain, the ionization fraction change quite a lot. So that people generally do not take into account these variations and just assume that these things are constant. Oxygen chemistry. Oxygen is one of the most abundant elements. It's very important. Of course, it's important as a coolant and important for the chemistry, formation of water. We do not know anything about that, I have to say, just a little bit. And in fact, we are waiting for Herschel to take off and tell us about the abundance of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. This is one of the most important things that people are struggling. We know that they exist. We have this beautiful picture from Spitzer that they show that PAHs are everywhere. But it's hard to take them into account. I mean, nobody has done yet, except for a few particular modelings, and this is very crucial because they can get, electrons can stick on them, and then again the ionization fraction can change quite a lot because, for example, metals can recombine on paths very quickly, but they do not recombine with electrons very quickly, so, you know, the structure can change. Surface chemistry is kind of a Pandora box, and many people are working on it. Fortunately, there are many people, not just astrophysicists, but real surface chemists that work on this very hard, so we hope that we can hear from them soon. H2 ortho to para ratio, this is another important issue, and it's another unknown, because ortho H2, as I'm sure you know, it's a slightly more excited energy than the para, and if it is abundant in molecular clouds, then the chemistry is different, because you can actually activate reactions that have activation energy, and they do not typically proceed in the cloud. So the other thing, yes.
The order to para energy ratio is not that much. Does it make such a big difference?
It can make such a big difference in the sense that in dark clouds, is the ortho H2 is supposed to be very low, like 10^-5 compared to the sun. But we cannot really test this observationally. So, not yet. Well, but it's the chemistry changes it. Yeah, I mean, it is still 3-1 as soon as it forms on grains, but then with you know there are exchanges with H3+, with H+, and that makes the transition between the ortho and para. And so in dark clouds where you have lots of H3+, you actually end up with very little ortho. This is what we think. But and the one way to test is actually the alteration, but I'm not going to talk about that. The other thing I wanted to make is that chemists, astrochemists say we have to be really patient because things, people discover new things, new molecules, and these new molecules, we cannot observe it in the laboratory. It's very difficult to observe. They're like very reactive ions, for example. So it's a real effort from the point of view of laboratory chemists, theoreticians, quantum mechanics calculations are going on every day, and we keep them very busy. So we need theoreticians, gas phase and solid state lab people, and they provide us, of course, I mean, this takes a long time, rate coefficients, collision rates, and the transition frequencies that are extremely important. Okay. No, I don't know why it doesn't stuck. Jeez.
It's always a Mac that does this. So
I try to. No, it doesn't work.
Did you buy it in Italy?
Yes, that's probably the point. Yeah. What do I do? I probably just need to shut down and start again, or? But it doesn't look right, actually. Well, yeah, that's... Sorry about this. I can actually turn down the computer and...
Is it a wireless mouse?
Oh, here it is. See. I just want to make sure that it's not doing anything. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
But I want to go back. Oh, no. Well, okay. It's okay. Well, let me just tell briefly the previous picture, because that was an important thing.
Well, then go back.
I can't.
No, you can go back.
Oh, let me see.
Yeah, you should reboot.
Not
great. Help.
Was it in the presenter mode?
What?
Was it in the presenter mode?
I don't know.
Can you
go in
the back?
Yeah. Okay. Or squid and it doesn't fall. Okay,
no,
so
yeah.
I just wanted to. Okay. Sorry about this. Let me just. Santa. Yeah, I have many different. This should be it. Okay. And now, let's see if it works. Okay, hopefully it works. So sorry, I lost a few minutes. So let me start with this work that probably not many of you know. This was a pioneer work, actually, by Hiroko Suzuki from Japanese group Nobeyama. She did this nice survey of ammonia and the CCS cores in molecular clouds, and she actually ended up with an interesting suggestion that actually we see, you know, an evolution in the chemistry in these regions, going from, you know, diffuse matter, where we are mostly the carbon in the ionized form, then in the dense core we have the transition between C+ and C, and then very soon CO form, and here we see lots of CCS cores, most of them are starless, and then with the time we actually get denser and denser conditions, finally N2 form, which takes a little bit longer time. We have ammonia core, stars form, and then there is the reverse process going on with the dispersal of the gas. I mean, this was, at least for me, at that time I was first year of PhD, it was a very kind of breakthrough and inspiration work. And unfortunately, I mean, Suzuki Hiroko, she left us very young, and so we all miss her. But this was, I think, the starting point. And unfortunately, we are still, you know, struggling and trying to understand if it is this is really the true picture or not. We know that, for example, in Sandberg and Algarve in 1995, they had this beautiful work on PDR, photodissociation regions, where it shows very easily, in a sense, why we have this transition and why we expect to have, you know, the transition between carbon-bearing species and nitrogen-bearing species. And this is due to the fact that carbon is very fast to make, and this can be seen by this simple picture here. Carbon interacts with the main molecular ion, which is H3+. This is a very fast reaction, and after this we have these chains of reactions with the molecular hydrogen, which means they're very fast, form CH3+ in very short time. This is the typical time scale. And then once this is formed, we have HCO+, and then we start this loop in molecular clouds, which is actually, we can consider it's a kind of a steady state condition. And you can see that, for example, the abundance of HC+ can give us constraints on the electron fraction. And two, on the other hand, it's much slower to be made because there is not a similar reaction as for the carbon. This doesn't proceed. This is just endothermic, proceeds in the other way. So we need to go through neutral-neutral reactions, which are slower, and the time scale for formation of a molecular hydrogen is about 1 million years, assuming that we are in a completely UV-shielded cloud. So you can see here that N2 actually start to be quite abundant at very large AV, and this is something similar to what happened in the molecular clouds, which in a sense are like PDR. I mean, we have lower UV fields and lower density. So, however, this simple picture that say, great, I mean, we understand everything now, it's complicated by the fact that molecular cloud cores are embedded in molecular clouds. So this means that we see, you know, lots of material. That we start to have evidences that there are kind of, you know, flows going toward molecular cloud cores. And this is, for example, one example that we have studied kind of recently with Scott Schnee and Alisa. In the past few years. So here we have like a map of the CO line, and we consider evaluated velocity gradients, local velocity gradients that give us, say, the magnitude of the velocity variation along the line of sight. And we see, you know, motions. I mean, the main conclusion here is that we see these kind of motions, about 0.05, between 0.05 and 0.3 kilometers per second within a size of 0.3 parsec. A similar work has been done by Swift, Welch, and James DiFrancesco, where they see this very nice core. This is another core in Taurus. This is TMC1C, and this is close to L1551. And this is the dust continuum, and they see this ridge of CCS. Remember that the CCS is young gas coming from the envelope. And they interestingly see that the line of the CCS is actually shifted from you know, the centroid velocities of, for example, N2H+, that trace very well the dust. So again, they conclude, and this is not velocity, say, frequency uncertainties. We know very well the frequency frequencies of these two lines. And again, look at the numbers. They have very similar conclusions to what we find, 0.05, 0.3 kilometers per second, within about 0.2 parsecs. So these are numbers that you know we should keep in mind for the modeling. I think that this is material that is actually falling toward, you know, the gravitational potential well of the core. The other thing that we have to deal with is the freeze out because this core.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
So, on an earlier time, velocity group, this kind of velocity shift has been interpreted as
could you go back?
So what is it? Just that it's different.
Well, I mean, it's yes, you're right. However, I mean, this is very hard to understand as a rotation because it's just a completely different velocity between the CCS and the N2H plus line.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, an overall gradient. And here, probably you do not see the where the errors are pointing, but there is a complete chaos in this cloud. There is not a coherence in the velocity field at all. We have, you know, errors pointing in completely different directions. So it's very hard to talk here about a rotation. We have, you know, a region where actually the most dense stuff it is. So here we have the dust peak, in which it looks that probably here we are approaching a more coherent field, and so probably at lower scales we can actually talk about some rotation. But
before you do the weight, so the color stuff is line of sight velocity.
Yes, it's the velocity here, yeah.
And the error, what does the error do?
Gradient.
The error is the velocity is the velocity gradient that we estimate from, so we take, for example, 9 pixels here, mm-hmm. and we do a fit of assuming something like, you know, we have like... the v, say the velocity that is equal to v0, the systemic velocity of the cloud, plus it's just a linear gradient.
It's the projected velocity.
Yeah.
Projected gradient of the projected velocity.
Yes, that's alpha and delta.
Color gradient.
Hmm?
It's like the color gradient.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then you can actually see the you know where so you have like redder or bluer
so
line.
This velocity is presumably obtained from synchrons, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it weird if it's flat though because it's a gradient on the plane of the sky in the line of sight?
Yeah, but if you have if you have sufficient.
No, I say we can't do much better than this.
Yeah. But I'm saying that maybe some of this, if you have sufficient quantum medium, it will be dominated not by this gradient.
The thing is that we do not see clumps here. I mean, it's kind of very smooth in this, for example, in this part. It's kind of a smooth. There are three main clumps. One is here, one is here, and one is here, and they're all connected by these streams.
But if you do similar analysis and use only the column densities, and will your vectors or gradients be similar to what you are getting here, or will be very different?
You mean column density gradients?
Yeah.
I mean, that is giving you the amount of material along the line of sight. I don't understand what...
You can be very easily messed up if you have fluctuations of density.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm simply suggesting is to have a similar map with column density gradients.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. If it would be very convincing if you tell
viewing
your talk.
That's with three other papers about this source.
It's
no.
Yeah, I mean it's very. It doesn't. Look.
Sorry to interrupt again. But the other side of his question, though,
yep.
This is perhaps a higher resolution than was done in the past. And
yes, sure.
So,
of course.
So let me ask the other side of what she asked. If you went back to all the cores that were interpreted by Alyssa especially,
yes,
as
I can answer. I whispered the answer to you. So
as rotation, would those be also still rotation, or would they become a similar thing?
No. So if you look at this is C18O. If you look at the N2H plus map, and then you look at just the region that Paolo was talking about, which is the peak of the core, this map is bigger than normally TMC1C is square that's sort of in the bottom half of that map. And if you look at the magnitude and direction of the N2H plus gradient, it's consistent with the magnitude and direction of the ammonia gradient that we published many years ago.
And that would be rotation, interpreted as rotation then?
Yes, but very carefully, that title of that paper was velocity gradients. We were always very careful not to say that it was rotation. And so there's probably some contamination in low resolution.
Yeah. An upper limit on the rotation in a sense.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Also, we had, I mean, in 2002 with Phil Myers and Mario Tafaya and Priscilla Benson, we published a paper on 60 cores where we mapped the N2H plus and actually measured the local gradients in each of them and showed that only a few have very, very coherent structure. In fact, are those that show the most narrow, almost thermal line widths, and everything else is a mess. So it's hard to...
So even if they rotate, the rotation doesn't dominate over the internal turbulence.
No. Oh, yeah, well.
That's right.
Yeah, that's
the thermal
line width.
Sorry. The thermal line width is, it's about, the temperature is, there is a gradient of temperature, so it's a little bit, but say, assume that it's 10 Kelvin, the temperature. So for these lines, for example, the N2H plus line, we have like 0.2 kilometer per second. Okay, so you don't want to hear about freeze-out, it seems, but unfortunately we have to hear about that because that's another important thing. So we saw these larger scale motions that we have to actually, what we have to do now is go even farther, so make bigger maps with high sensitivity and high spatial resolution and actually see what's happening at even larger scales, but it takes time. Freeze out, this is something that is known since long time ago, even before this, but here I quote the paper from which I took this kind of old picture, but it's very instructive. Here it's plotted the time versus densities for two very simple equations. One is the free fall time, and this is the depletion or freeze out time, which depends upon the sticking coefficients. So this means that you have gas, molecules or atoms sticking on the grains when they meet each other, and they do not, it's very hard then to evaporate again because the temperature of the dust is too low. So the depletion time scale depends on the sticking coefficient, which is about 1, and for heavier species, not for hydrogen. Then we have the density of the number density of dust grains. We have the cross section and the thermal velocity. So in general, we have like 10 to the 9 divided by the density per year. So you can see that at densities, assuming that we have here alpha equal to 1, that already at density that is 10 to the 4, a few times 10 to the 4, the freeze-out takes over, and we start to have lots of molecules freezing out. It took almost 10 years after this theoretical thing to actually see this, and I will show you later on. But this is another thing that we have to take into account. We can't really talk about constant abundances along the line of sight for that is one reason. So let me talk a little bit about the large scale structure. Here we do not have the velocity yet. Maybe we will do some in the future. This is a work that is almost in press, done by Jaime Pineda with Alisa at CFA. And here we observed, we have the complete data. We have three isotopologues of the carbon monoxide molecules, and we have in the whole Perseus molecular cloud. So we have here in grayscale, we have the two mass extinction, and then we have the region where the CO isotopologues have been observed, and here we have the C18O that only a fraction of this region has been observed. All data has been taken with the SCRAO antenna. What Jaime has done, he actually divided the region in sub-regions to see actually if there were differences between different parts of Perseus, and these different regions belong in different area in this line of sight velocities versus dust temperature plot. So we decided to use this a way to actually have a better division between the various parts. Of course, we estimated the X factor, so the column density of H2 divided by the integrated intensity of the CO line, and what we found are typical number, 1, 2 times 10 to the 20 per cubic centimeter, per square centimeter per kilometer per second per Kelvin. And then with the variations, that so the lower values are actually found around star-forming regions. But I don't want to go through this because I want to tell you actually other interesting things that we found. So don't pay any attention with all these curves. I will not tell you anything about this. You can ask me later. These are all the dots, the CO spectra, 12 CO. This is the integrated intensities versus the extinction for the whole Perseus region and for the six regions that have the names here across Perseus. So you can see that actually this is quite a mess, and there is a lot of scatter, and the scatter is due to the fact that the different regions have different properties. So what are the main results of this very detailed work that, you know, I have to stress that has been possible only because we had this beautiful complete data? Well, first of all, we calculated very accurately the threshold extinctions for the 12 CO, 13 CO, and C18O. These are the numbers, which is, again, an important thing for the modeling. We use PDR codes to actually determine, you know, what was going on and if, you know, there were variations in which physical properties between the different regions. And it turns out that the main difference is the line width, so the degree of turbulence within these regions. And in fact, for example, one thing that I just want you to notice, that this B5 region, which is the most quiescent one, has a 12 CO line that flattens out, so saturates at quite low AV, and it is consistent with just a thin slab of material at a certain density. So what we think is going on here is that all the CO photons are trapped inside because we have very narrow lines, and we just see the external shell of the B5 region. On the other hand, if we go in a very excited star-forming regions like NGC 1333, where there is lots of activity inside, turbulence increase, and we are able to actually get the photons coming from deep into the clouds, and we have lots of bright CO lines. So that makes a difference, and of course this means that we are seeing density changes along the line of sight, in the particular case of NGC 1333, but not in this other. Another point is that the excitation temperature for the CO, and this is just to point out that CO is not a good thermometer, as many people think. The excitation temperature for the 12 CO line is 5 Kelvin for all the points that have extinction less than 2 magnitude, and approaches probably what is it is actually the LTE value at 13 Kelvin at extinction larger than 4 magnitude. And always, all around the cloud, the Perseus cloud, the excitation temperature is always smaller than the dust temperature, which has been estimated from IRAS 60 and 100 micron colors.
C18 orb must be optically thin.
Yeah.
And at these points, they correspond to 12 CO or I'm
I'm confused.
The
I mean,
plot, is it 12 CO?
No, no, this is only the 12 CO. I didn't show all the plots.
Okay. But so if you go to 18th CO, you get everything very different.
You get different things in the sense that you get, say, the saturation, it happens at higher AV. Yeah, because it gets. But C18O, we do not see actually the saturation for the C18O at this spatial resolution. We need to go at higher spatial resolution to see that. So the conclusion from this is that we actually counted all the points, and I thought that this also is kind of an interesting thing, that about 60% of the CO gas is subthermally excited, so the majority of the gas must be at densities that are below this value here, which is typical, I mean, the value that we assume for molecular clouds. So I don't think that's correct. So let's go back a little, so try to connect again the large scale to the small scale. Here is again the TMC1C. This is the column density map. So, Alex, you may be interested. This is the column density of H2 across the TMC1C. And this is the dust peak where we have this kind of velocity coherence. And this is the dust temperature. So you can see this nice anti-correlation between the dust temperature and the AV. This study has been done using the JCMT and the 30 meter, and we have several molecules observed. So the interesting thing that here we have strong evidence that the dust temperature is actually going about 6 Kelvin in this particular core, and the central density, where the central density is about 10 to the 6 per cubic centimeter, and we have a gas temperature determined from the CO line, which is 12 Kelvin, so exactly at the same position where the, you know, we see this cold dust. So this means that, of course, the CO line is not tracing at all the center of the core. And also we found this kind of a strange behavior that the temperature drops going outwards. And that's just due, as we will see if I will have the time, probably not, that this is simply due to the fact that the volume density decreases. So we have subthermally excited CO outside. So it doesn't trace the temperature at all within the core. This is probably an interesting plot from the discussion of a couple of days ago. So it's the dust temperature versus the extinction. So these are all the points. So you can see that we reach about 6 Kelvin toward the center, where the extinction is 90 magnitude. And this is the theoretical curve from the model of Zucconi et al., which is actually very similar to Neil Evans' models, which takes into account the heating of the dust due to the interstellar radiation field only. And now...
So looking at that, yeah. It doesn't look like the model is a very good fit.
Yeah, in fact, yes.
It looks like there's a very consistent evolution. So do you have any thoughts on what might be the
reason of the discrepancy, you mean? Yeah, it could be that actually the dust properties that are used in this model, and also Neil Evans model, where they use the normal opacities for dust grains, may not be completely the case.
Did they consider the dust getting bigger toward the center?
Yeah, that's... No, they didn't. Yes. So now let me show you this, what I think, for me, this has been the most beautiful...
No.
Okay. Yes. The heating is the interstellar radiation field only.
TMC1C is, they is me, so I can answer the question. TMC1C is the starless core.
Yeah,
so
but
there's no internal heating.
Yeah, he was talking about the model, I think.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's just the interstellar radiation field.
But for AB equals, say, 60 or 80?
Well, I mean, they follow, inside they have a core with the density structure, so they follow the UVs inside. So inside you do not have UV and you have lower temperature.
Do they follow the infrared?
Yes, they have also the infrared radiation in the model, yeah. So that's, the limit that they reach.
So bigger grains make cooler dust, so maybe that would do that.
Yes.
Can I also ask about the systematic arrow on the y-axis? Is the scatter, can we believe?
Well, the scatter, this is a spherical cloud. And the TMC1C is...
Because in this way, I was talking about, you have a German cloud, you have different heating rates.
Ah, yeah. Yes, I mean, TMC1C, it's very turbulent, in fact.
No, it's the scatter all the way. Because you have large variation.
Yeah, but it's also a geometry effect, Tom. Sorry to interrupt. But
that's for a much larger Mach number than is in this.
I don't think this is... I think this is just a geometry effect. Okay, so this, as I was saying before, was the best plot I ever seen so far, I think, from the point of view of... an amazing thing, and I will explain to you what it is. So this is the first measurement of the gas temperature inside a dense core. Finally, with the VLA observations, I'm not going to show you the desaturated ammonia data, but this is just ammonia. Ammonia at a very small size scale, a few hundreds AUs. Now we are really going deep into the core. You see the single dish data here that were taken with the Bonn. They were tracing, temperature of about 8 Kelvin, and now we are really going deep into it and reaching this 6 Kelvin temperature in the very center of the 1544. This is another core in which dust grain models. Again, we're giving more like 7.5 Kelvin of temperature. So there is a real discrepancy, and Bruce spoiled my conclusions at the end. But yes, I mean, that is the thing that it's obvious. I mean, you need to change to make these grains, dust grains, bigger. So this is the conclusion. Again, 6 Kelvin at within 1,000 AU, 2 times 10 to the 6 per cubic centimeter. Well, the dust we see, it has been modeled before. I mean, you have to have some modeling behind the dust structure. So the different wavelengths that were observed were consistent with the central temperature of 7.5 Kelvin, which the gas gave better constraints on that.
What do hydrostatic models?
Well, the problem is that people do not tend to use temperature gradients in the hydrostatic models. I mean, typically they...
While you're modeling this, you're not also doing the hydrostatic structure?
I mean, these are you're talking about... These are data, okay? Yes. It's not the model. It's but yes, so there is a model curve that I didn't point out, but yes, so this is the model that was the Zucconi model adapted, so forced to be 6 Kelvin, at the center. And we have actually this value of the central density is coming in fact from this particular model.
But did you guys make a model of the whole density profile of this form?
Yeah. I mean, we have within these, the model curve, we actually, this is tracing the temperature and the density profile.
Right, so you must have an N-bar plot. Do you have that on your computer? Or?
Not. But it's, it's like a kind of Bonnor Ebert sphere. And... which is actually unstable because the density contrast is larger than I can check later, but I have to look at the paper. So this is I want to point out again that this region where we have this very low temperature is actually the CO freeze-out zone, where CO is completely gone. This is at least from what we see from observations. And this is the size scale. Now, it's kind of late. And
if you take the lowest at the freeze-out boundary, right at the edge of the freeze-out boundary, you have a density. So that gives you a freeze time. Mm-hmm. And how does that compare to the dynamical time there? Can you get an age from that boundary?
Well, at the boundary of the CO freeze-out zone, we have about, say, few times 10 to the 4 in density. The freeze time, you have to divide 10 to the 9 by, say, 10 to the 4. So it's, 2 times 10 to the 4. It's about, I think, 5...
Years.
Yes, 10 to the 5.
Years.
And the dynamic...
if it lasted longer than that, the freeze-out zone would be further out.
Assuming that you do not have any CO coming from the envelope of the core, which...
But that might be a way to get an age.
Yeah, again, assuming that you do not have any...
The freeze-out zone would be tiny.
Yes, but I think that, this simple picture could be true if you have an isolated core. So maybe in, some Bok globule, you can do this kind of exercise. But I'm not sure you can do in a molecular cloud, unfortunately.
This free zone, does a zone, the size, does it include the desorption, a cosmic ray, or other sources?
This is observation. We just measured.
This is a place where you should...
No, what I'm saying is... No, you have
to be fuzzy on this observation.
No, what I'm saying is... Okay, let me rephrase it. You want to estimate an age based on the formula for depletion, but you have to couple that.
Well, I mean, the desorption is a cosmic ray impulse heating, and it doesn't do anything at these densities. I mean, it does a little bit, but not much.
Freezing was...
I guess you know all about the web, but UEI knows.
Oh, yeah.
On this specific
globe. Yes, we did it together, in fact.
Do you remember?
information about that?
Yeah, of course, yes. Yeah, she has, I'm not going, I mean, I have zero time. So you just tell me when to stop, because, you
tomorrow.
Okay, I stop tomorrow, great. Go ahead. So I'll show you the CO hole, because now, Paolo, you see how, you know, how we did that. So this is the dust emission at 1544, where we see this beautiful temperature gradient. This is the dust peak. So in 1999, we wanted to determine the CO column density with the, you know, the thinnest isotope log, the C17O120. So we went to the 30 meter, and this is the map of this region here, and this is what we saw. So there was like a you know, complete anti-correlation between the dust continuum and the CO. So this is the hole that I'm talking about, and the, you know, to be able to have this flux here, we made the toy model, and from the toy model, there was no way to reproduce this structure here unless you really have CO completely gone within the 7,000 AU. So CO must disappear almost completely. You know, the limit is like 98% of the CO must be gone. So you have these grains with lots of CO molecules on top. So, of course, the things change. I mean, the opacity must change, and probably they, you know, stick together. And the N2H plus is now much better. We did at the same time the N2H plus map and found that was actually very similar to the continuum map. So we went on and go ahead and also map the N2D plus, because we knew since 1978 when Alex Dalgarno and Steve Lepp wrote the paper about the fact that if you freeze out neutrals, you must have deuterium fractionation enhancing, and this is just proof that what they predicted was true. Actually, the N2D plus is even better than N2H plus, because the peak is just coincident with the dust peak. The N2H plus, there is kind of depletion or probably optical death going on. So these were the main conclusions that we found. First is that the N2H plus and the N2D plus are very good tracers, and this is good to know, because we want to study what's going on in these cores, so we can't use the CO. And then the defractionation increases as... Okay.
So what's the time scale for depletion of N2?
Well, I mean, it's the same. There is a little change. No, actually, N2H plus has the same weight of the CO, more or less. So it's actually exactly the same. So you have to divide 10 to the 9 by the density, which is 10 to the 6.
So why is one is the one and the other?
Haha, that's a very good question.
Is it formed much more rapidly?
This is something that is still,
it's a big... out of equilibrium, it's still forming right now.
Yeah. But I think it's a bit complicated. But I think what's going on, but it's just the thing is that the N2 chemistry is lower than the CO. Okay, so you have lots of CO coming in, and N2 starts to form when actually CO is already quite frozen. When you have CO mantles, the binding energies of molecules actually kind of drop compared to, you know, bare dust or dust with water on top. So this is what is maybe going on. But people do not take into account this. I mean, I'm kind of begging Yuri to do that, to put this differentiation in the, you know, in the binding energy as we go deep inside.
The grains are saturated, and the zero time for the N2 is later than the CO. So both.
But don't take my words as... So I just wanted to show you these... I told you. You stop me, Elise, okay? You just say stop, because I'm a little late. I just wanted to show you this, because this is another important tracers. So if you want in the future become observers and observe the central portion of these quartz, I suggest you to use this, which is now... we have been doing surveys, and we found lots of H2D plus, actually, in this starless core, and this is very good to trace the kinematics in the very center,
okay,
I think.
Pick whatever you want to say in the last 3 minutes.
Yes, okay. So this is, I will just talk a little bit about this, because I think it's fine. So this is to let you understand how chemistry works. So probably this is a good point to stop, and I will show you a couple of figures at the end on this temperature issue again. So when we started this work, we were excited by the fact that we saw this larger deuterium fractionation in the center of the core. So we said, well, I mean, we should probably go and look for H2D+, because actually, you know, the deuterium fractionation is due to the H2D+ molecule. It's the H2D+ that react with CO or N2 and then give the deuterium and form all these deuterated species that we see. So we followed the chemistry. We had these nice chemical models. We said, great, I mean, we can actually probably observe H2D+, and we predicted that from the models and all the, you know, line of sight integration, etc., that we were all getting a line of 0.1 Kelvin. This is just to tell you, I mean, how chemistry works. You really have to go ahead with observations. Otherwise, there is no way, you know, that we can understand things. So we made a proposal at CSO. This line is at 372 gigahertz. And we said, great, we need, you know, 4 nights of integration. And we saw the line in 1 hour. So this was, you know, completely, for us, it was a complete shock. I said, well, I mean, what do we do now? And so the thing is that chemistry works like this, that, you know, you have to make observation and test the models. And what the models were missing, these are the numbers that we found, these are the conclusions that we got, saying that actually to have these such large abundances, we have to have very much, say, most of the material gone, but not actually the nitrogen. And it also means that the abundances predicted were actually that the H2D plus over H3 plus was united. So this means, with a very simple calculation, you can actually go from here to here. So the chemistry was actually missing these doubly deuterated species. That's why, you know, they started to actually include them, and finally we found agreement with the observations. And this is all work by say, Roberts, Helen Roberts, Rick Herbst, Tom Miller. And then there had been a large activity in the lab, the Hugo and Schlemmer in Cologne. They're actually measuring the collisional coefficients that we didn't know. Okay, so that's, let me just show you, couple of things. This very quickly, well, we did a survey of the H2D+ and found that, as I told you, I mean, it's a really good tracer of not just the center of the cores, but actually the very much evolved starless cores. So if you want to know what's going on just before the star is born, we need to observe that. So this is something that I'm doing with kind of playing with Eric Kito, not long distance now, but it's okay. And we have started to actually do a little bit more quantitative modeling of the structure of the cores, including some chemistry, the freeze-out inside and the photodissociation outside. The photoelectric heating has been treated in a very accurate way. I think it's the first time that we do actually the actual averaging and of the photons inside the core, and well, and we follow the radiative transfer, and we have, you know, for cores like 1544, this is a structure, typical structure, say, of 1544. So this is kind of the density structure that Fred was asking before. So we have very peaked structure here, and then it goes. We just follow until 10 to the 2, and this is the abundance of CO that you see. I mean, it just drops in the center, and we have the exponential to the minus AV, so the transmission, no photons inside. And this is the the temperature structure that we actually determine, including the photoelectric heating. So things are very different if there is no photoelectric heating. And the CO excitation temperature, again, you see that the CO is very bad in tracing in the temperature, because it gets subthermally excited here, and then it gets depleted in the center. So we just...
So do you have to assume a time, an age?
This is, I mean, these are... Well, we evolved a little bit the this Bonnot-Ebert spheres, and then we stop at some point when actually the, you know, the density is similar to the, because it is kind of an unstable Bonnot-Ebert. So Erica has the hydrocode. And so it follows the evolution until the central density is the same as the one that we observe. And then we have the structure, the velocity, the density structure. And then we run the thermal balance, the energy balance. And we have the gas temperature and the line profiles, whatever. I'm not going to show you this.
We would also have a velocity distribution and some compression.
Yes, I'll show you.
So it's collapsing without magnetic diffusion.
No.
Plain collapse.
Yes, this is an unstable Von Ribbert.
So this conversation will be continued at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All right. If you want, I can show you this thing here and that just to answer his question. And this is the cosmic ionization rate difference. So we are actually testing a way to actually measure if there are, cosmic ionization differences at the edge of the core. And this is the Fermi's dust opacity that, we have to drop. We have to increase the dust opacity by a factor of 4 to actually get to 6 Kelvin. So that's a number we have to multiply by 4, okay? And I don't show you this. This is just the equilibrium structure. No, this is just for him. Just for him. So, okay, well, this is the difference. Without photoelectric heating, there is less stability. So with the photoelectric heating, we have a much larger temperature outside, and we can actually have a denser region. So it affects the stability a little bit. Okay, yeah, so that's it. Sorry, but I told you to stop. All right.